Hi, everyone. It's Amna. Welcome to another episode of Settle In. My guest today is best-selling author Soman Chainani. And even if you don't know him by name, you definitely know his hit series, The School for Good and Evil, which was also turned into a hit Netflix movie. We talked to him today about his new book, though, which is a bit of a departure from the fantasy world he wrote about previously. It's called Young World. It imagines a world right here in which a teenage boy suddenly gets swept into power and becomes president of the United States. There's a great story behind that. We talked about how that teenager manages the presidency. We talked about why Soman has always found female villains to be way more interesting than the men. And we also talked about the challenges he faces now as an author, talking to teenagers, trying to get them interested in reading, and young boys in particular. What he has to say is fascinating. So settle in and enjoy my conversation with Soman Chainani. Soman Chainani, welcome to Settle In. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I mean, this is a real pleasure.
It's a real pleasure to have you here. I'm such a fan of the book. I tore through it in just a couple of days. I know I'm not your intended audience.
Everybody's the intended audience for this one. The whole country is the intended audience.
Okay, before we get into the books, we always like to hear a little bit about the person we're going to hear from. I want to know about you, about how you got to be you. So let's start with that. You grew up in Florida, right?
Outside of Miami. Florida. Yep.
Tell me about your family. Tell me about growing up there and what a young Soman was like.
It was a fascinating sort of upbringing there because my grandparents were the first Indians in Florida. Like, there had been no other Indians.
Literally
the first. There are streets named after them in Ocala and Daytona. Like, no one had ever seen, you know, Indian people before. And so my family lived there ever since. But when I grew up, you know, I grew up in Miami, went to school there. I felt like I was pretty, ironically, one of the only Indian kids around.
Really, even in your generation.
Even in my generation. You know, Miami now is such a hotbed for Indians. It was not when I was younger.
So what was that like? Did you feel like you stood out? Was that hard in any way?
Yes, I felt very different. I went to a prep school where there weren't many, you know, people of color. And I think I just always felt different. Also, I was built differently. I was extremely skinny in that way that a lot of Indian teenagers are. You go to India and you see them and you're like, oh, I'm totally normal. But in the U.S., you feel so scrawny, you know? So I felt small. I felt skinny. I was, you know, struggling with my sexuality. So I just had so many differences.
Yeah.
And I think that led me to escape. I needed to, in the way that, you know, children did, especially back then, disassociate into fantasy worlds of their own.
So you started that back as a child. Did you start writing back then?
I didn't write, but I lived in kind of the Disney world. I was presented with all the Disney movies when I was young. You know, like my grandparents used to collect them on VHS. And so we used to take them back to my house. And back then it was like you would watch them over and over and over again until the tape burned out. And so I felt like I was raised by Disney. I just remember coming home from school and watching those movies so many times to the point of even now, so many years later, I know every scene, you know, every frame. I know everything about Disney.
So growing up, that you're a child of the 80s and 90s, like I am. What movies are we talking about here? It was like Little Mermaid,
Lion King, Robin Hood, Alice in Wonderland, you know, Sleeping Beauty was a big one in our house. So, I mean, these were the movies I was watching. And what was interesting about it is I was always rooting for the villain.
And really?
Even though I felt like I was such a good kid, like I always hated getting in trouble. I was like the golden boy. Like, and here I am rooting for Maleficent and Cruella, especially the female villains. I loved them.
Why? Why do you think that is?
I think there were two things. One, when I looked at all the villains, they looked a little bit more like me because they were that sort of like slinky frame that I had, you know, that I'm very tiny. I felt like there was something about them that reminded me of myself or how I would like to be.
Interesting.
You know? So there was something that I associated with them. I saw none of myself in the kind of, you know, blonde, beautiful heroes.
Yeah.
The villains were always slightly darker, you know? And so I think I saw myself in them. I also thought female villains in Disney, which is so fascinating, because I think at the time, if you look at all the classic movies, there were like 52 villains and only 7 were female.
Is that right?
Those are the ones we remember, right?
Wow.
If you ask people to name villains, they start naming the 7 females.
Yeah.
So I think it's that they didn't have weaponry. They didn't have brute strength. It was all about intelligence, manipulation, seduction, all the things that make a villain kind of so delicious.
Which is kind of more evil in a way, right?
100%. I think it just, there was a glamorousness to them. And I think I started to, you know, feel that kinship with them. But as I got older and studied those movies more and more, started to realize that Disney, the logic was often wrong, and that the hero would win in these movies without deserving to. And so I started to realize that I was right to root for the villains because they actually deserved to win in a lot of stories that they lost. And Little Mermaid is, of course, the classic, because if you watch the Disney film, you're watching a heroine who has so many flaws. She's disobedient. She knows nothing about the prince
impetuous. She's in love with. She's headstrong.
She's shallow.
Yeah.
She's a traitor to her father going to Ursula. She's like everything. And then she signs a contract that she could have read, doesn't read it, and then spends the rest of the movie trying to get out of it.
Correct.
So, like, there's nothing about Ariel that's, to me, redeeming.
So you're cheering for Ursula?
I feel like Ursula does nothing wrong in the Disney version of Little Mermaid. She is just chilling in her cave, eating her little people, doing nothing. So
that is what we call a hot take. Please continue.
I'm watching this, and then I ended up going to Harvard undergrad, where, long story, I end up in a fairy tale seminar. Me and 12 girls. And we're studying all the original stories. And that was the first time in my life I ever learned the original fairy tales. I had never read the Grimm's Tales, never knew the Hans Christian Andersen version of Little Mermaid. And I think that shock of learning that all those stories that I learned as a kid were sanitized, corporatized, you know, and really a lie, I think is what radicalized me in some shape, way, or form.
Radicalized you.
Radicalized me in starting to realize that adults were making decisions for kids that were not necessarily in our best interest, you know, and that kids everywhere else, because you go to Europe, they learn the original stories. They know the Disney versions are wrong. And so there was something uniquely in the way we learned fairy tales in America that felt off to me. And it was an adult's way of sort of making us believe in this happily ever after myth.
You were like, it can't be this simple. It can't be the good guys and the bad guys. It can't be that clean.
I think it's the seed of our political problems, honestly.
You're jumping far ahead, but please go ahead.
I believed this when I was, you know, talking about the School for Good and Evil. I used to tell kids this.
Yeah.
I said, our country's getting more polarized. We're starting to demonize each other in different ways. And I said, I think it comes back from Disney, because Disney says the good guy always wins, right? And the good guy's always identifiable, right? And whoever stands in the good guy's way, no matter what, will be destroyed at the end.
Right, and that's the bad guy.
And that's the bad guy. And so we all think we're the good guy in our story.
Sure.
Right? Everybody does.
Everyone's the hero of their
own story. Both sides think they're the good side.
Yeah.
So as long as you have 100% conviction in that, you're going to think the other side has to be destroyed. Anyone else who grew up with Grimm's and Hans Christian Andersen, those fairy tales, it has nothing to do with if you're the good guy or bad guy. It's 100% based on what you do.
Wow.
So in some versions of Red Riding Hood, she dies at the end because she's a moron. In others, she's clever and escapes the wolf, right? It's just about what you do and are you clever enough to, you know, escape. And there's this gray area to it. And it's the idea that in a happy ending, in a real fairy tale, depends on what the kid did, not what adults decide for them. And so I think the whole act of writing The School for Good and Evil, which was 13 years of my life, was this attempt to rewrite my childhood and create an alt fairy tale universe.
So when did the writing in earnest begin? How did you come to The School for Good and Evil ultimately?
I think I always processed my emotions by writing. So, you know, I had a seventh grade English teacher who I dedicated one of the first School for Good and Evils to, who told me I would be a novelist one day. She's like, because anytime I give you an assignment, you try to turn it creative. You're always trying to not do the assignment and do something else. She's like, you're going to write books one day. And I never considered it seriously.
Never did.
No, because I think a few things. One, I had Indian parents. And when you have Indian parents, you have to have a real job.
Well, I was going to ask you about this because your parents were born and raised here, right?
So my mom was born in New York. My dad was born in India.
Okay. So you had some of the, for our generation, first generation American, typical South Asian parent pressure type stuff, which is like doctor, lawyer,
first generation,
engineer.
But then Indian parents who are born here, I think are worse.
You think they're worse?
I think they are.
Why?
I think they have like memories of what their parents like pressured them and they become even more. I feel like
they're like trying to one up their parents.
Yes,
on the pressure.
I feel like the pressure from my mom to have like a proper job was actually, I think, you know, even stronger than from my dad. So I think there was this feeling of, you know, you need a real job. And back then, there were only a few established tracks, you know. So I went into business after Harvard. I worked as a pharmaceutical consultant. I'm trying to say that without bursting out laughing.
Did you really?
Can you imagine?
And how were you at that job?
I entered the recruiting portal at Harvard, and that was the only place that would take English majors. I think they were desperate. And I would sit in the corner working on my novel. I was writing a fairy tale novel that ultimately was not The School for Good and Evil, but clearly my head was going there. And I got fired. And then I got fired from the next thing. And it was very obvious that
this was not working.
And so my dad's like, you have to do something different. And so I still wasn't committed to being a novelist. Something about it felt too lonely, scary, self-determinative in a way that I wasn't ready for.
Yeah.
And so I went to film school.
You did?
I went to
Why film school?
I felt like, you know, I don't know, other than it felt collaborative.
Yeah.
It felt like there was a storytelling engine to it.
Yeah.
And I felt like, you know, I could go the screenwriting route or the directing route. And at the time, this is when independent cinema was huge. It was just so glamorous also. So it just felt like the safer place to go rather than sit in a room and try to write a novel.
Yeah.
You know.
Which sounds really terrifying if you've never written one before,
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
So how did you do it?
So then I went to film school, came out sort of a hot commodity out of film school. Well, here's the other interesting detour before we get to film school. Right before I went to film school, they waitlisted me and said, you don't have any experience, you know, in film. You're just, you know, coming straight out of your pharmaceutical consulting job. Great. You know, reapply when...
That's a tough segue.
Reapply when you have some film experience.
Yeah.
So I applied for a job as Mira Nair's assistant.
Really?
So...
Legendary filmmaker Mira
Nair.
Yes.
Okay. And also the mother of Zoran Mamdani.
Correct.
So...
It all comes back to our current politics.
Yes.
I'm telling you.
This is what's wild. So I got a job as her assistant, her personal assistant. So... for about a year, I think it was 2004, 2005, Zoran was maybe 11, 12, always around, always, you know, there were, he just was part of life. You know, I was running around helping her right at the sort of peak of her career. And I was learning a ton. You know, I was just, I felt like I might be there for a very long time. And then they took me off the wait list and I had to make the decision whether to go or stay working for her.
Wow.
I just knew I had to go, so I went. And remember working for her on a, you know, Sunday and being in film school on Monday. So, yeah, it was kind of crazy.
So did the film schooling help when you finally said, okay, I think I have a world in my head. I need to get down on paper.
So I came out of there sort of a hot commodity because of the fact, I think I had worked for Mira and knew what it took to be a director. So I came out of film school with two scripts, you know, a short film that was getting a lot of attention and going to film festivals. And so I got offered a TV job. They wanted to make my, they were funding my debut feature. Like there was a lot of stuff happening.
Yeah.
And so for about 2 years, all those things were happening and everything was, you know, sort of taking place at the same time. But then two things happened. One, I was getting a lot of notes from executives that I never liked taking. It felt like I was always like diluting the vision of whatever I was working
on. Notes are like feedback on your work,
feedback,
right?
Yeah. It's just the typical Hollywood thing of sort of dumbing everything down. At the same time, the financial crisis had happened and a lot of these studios were losing funding, projects were shutting, and everything that had come so quickly started to close down in terms of, you know, all those projects. One by one, the boilers turned off, you know? And so there came a time where I think... And I had The School for Good and Evil in my head as like a movie. Like I'd always thought of it as, you know, I'll write it as a screenplay or something like that. And I think there came a time where I was like, I can't handle anyone else like telling me what to do or having control over my future. And that's when I started to actually write it. I think that it was out of this desire to, after all these years of being ping-ponged, you know, the pharmaceutical consultant, film school, and then working for all these people, like I just felt like I wasn't in control.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to write something that was mine. I didn't care if it got published. And I think that's where it started.
I mean, it did get published.
It did get published.
8 books in your series got published. As you mentioned, over 13 years of your life went to this series. Over 4.5 million copies sold, translated into dozens of languages, made into a hit Netflix movie. Could you have seen all of that when you first put the first book out there into the world?
I mean, no one can ever see any of that stuff. The only thing I would say is 17 out of 18 publishers rejected it for the same reason. Hmm. And they all gave the same reason of, this is a highly romantic story and romance is not allowed in books for 9 and up. You can do it in young adult, 14 and up, but not in what's called the middle grade market.
Okay.
And I thought, that's ridiculous. Every time I hang, you know, see 9 and 10 year old girls, like all they're doing is talking about their crushes and things and, you know, making up fantasy romances in their head. I'm like, and you look at Taylor Swift's fan base now, it's all 10 year old girls.
Yep.
So I thought that's absurd. And there was one publisher, one editor at HarperCollins who just decided to swim upstream mm-hmm. and said, let's try. What's the worst that happens? And that was the bet. The bet was, let's try romance in middle grade.
I mean, feels like it was a good bet.
That was a good bet. Now, then, a lot of people do it. But back then, it was definitely against the grain.
I mean, when you've taken such a unique path mm-hmm. to that place of success, and suddenly it's upon you, and it's everything around you, and it's, I assume, become sort of a driving life force, mm-hmm. right? It's like one comes out, and then you think, okay, there's going to be another one, and there's another in the series, and you're making a Netflix series, next Netflix movie. You're a best-selling author. Mm-hmm. How does that land with you? Like, how does that success sit with you?
I think I felt pressure for each book to be better, not for them, but for me. It was this feeling of, like, how good can I make something? And I wanted each book to be better than the next and to satisfy the audience more than the next. So I never felt like I got to enjoy any of it. Also because you have to remember, I was delivering a 700-page book almost every year, and I was touring for 2 or 3 months a year.
Wow.
So there was very little in terms of a normal life.
Yeah.
It felt like being, you know, almost like a musician on tour. Like you're either producing an album or you're touring with an album and you can't have kind of a normal life. And, you know, I was living in New York. I was, you know, dating, trying to find somebody. But at the same time, I felt like they always came second to the work. Like the career was the boyfriend. Yeah. You know what I mean? And it was only when I finished the last book and the movie came out that I was able to like take a breath. I was like, I think that's it. I feel like there's nowhere else to go. Like we hit the peak. Anything else from here is just going to be, you know, it's going to feel like an anticlimax.
I mean, I mentioned to you, my girls are fans. Mm. They've read the whole series. For anyone unfamiliar, I don't want to oversimplify it here, but you have two female leads, right? There's sort of a classically like pink clad pretty
princess,
one, princess and Sophie, and then Agatha, who's more unpopular and kind of wears all black, is very brooding, and they end up in the opposite school they'd intended to, a school for good and the school for evil, where they make villains in one and they make heroes in the other. But it's this focus on female leads that fascinates me, because you mentioned a little bit about how the female villains really fascinated you. But I wonder, when you're writing, like, are you writing for young girls? Do you find boys who read these books too?
Yeah.
This always fascinates me.
Lots of boys read it too. I think over time, the audience just expanded because it became known as just one of those books that when you're in middle school, if you're a good reader, you read.
You read.
And there's not that many of them. So I feel like that became one of them. I think, to me, yes, if I look at all those books now, they are sort of a female fantasy, right? It is female id, and I think that's why it caught on so much with, you know, girls of all ages, honestly, because they are the powerful ones. The boys are often objectified and don't quite have it together in the head most of the time. And the girls are just kind of the rock stars of that world, you know, which is funny then, because when, you know, I came to this new book, it flips. And it's very much a book about teenage boys.
Yes.
And I think a lot of it is just exploring different sides of myself and being able to say I have both sides, right? I have a female voice I can inhabit, and I also have a super kind of male voice I can inhabit, and to enjoy that balance and to be able to work in both worlds, you know?
How did you know when you were done with the series?
I think the movie coming out felt like now it's a different thing, because there's, you know, you have to remember, books and movies, the scale is so different.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're talking, yes, 4.5 million books sold, 110 million people watched the Netflix movie. So it's just, I told you, so
different.
Now that, like, everybody has a different view of what the story is, like, because the, you know, the movie casts different people. So in a way, as an author, you're just like, I can understand why George R. R. Martin doesn't want to finish those books. Because you're kind of like, there's just too much in the subconscious of the audience that's visual to then, it just becomes very difficult. You feel like, okay, let me step back. If I ever come back to this world, it'll be in a different form. But
yeah,
I've done it. Like you know?
Difficult for you to manage, like to meet their expectations, or?
I think it's more a confusion, like in my head, because I'd also been on the movie set and there were a lot of changes made to the movie. And so you just start to get a little confused in your own head.
Because it's appearing now in real life, maybe not in a way that perfectly aligns with the way it did
yes,
in yours.
And you're getting a lot of fan art and a lot of fan reaction, and you're getting a lot of commentary on the movie. And, you know, I also haven't looked in the books in a while. So, like, your head starts to get very confused. And so I just thought, I knew I was done. I knew I was done. And at the same time, I had fallen in love and had my first kind of real relationship. And I ended up moving from New York after 22 years to St.
Where did you move to?
St. Louis. I fell in love with a farmer who, when I met him, was a goat farmer and now has no goats and only has cows. So, I moved to St. Louis, a city I had never been to, after only 3 dates.
You moved to Missouri after 3 dates?
3 dates. I just knew.
Wow.
I think he was my getaway car, another Taylor Swift reference. I think I was ready to start life over.
So did you write this book from St. Louis?
Yeah, I could not have written it in New York. It required 3.5 years of just silence and getting to know myself in a different way and starting over. It required a change of scenery. It required a change of headspace, it required a change of everything.
Yeah.
Because the book is so different.
It is so different.
Yeah.
So let's lay this out for people now. It's called Young World.
Yes.
The central character is a teenage boy. It has a neon orange cover. Mm. It signals, like just seeing it, it signals like danger and revolution and sort of uncertainty and fear. How did this book idea come to you? How did that percolate?
I think the feeling was I was going to be fairy tale guy forever, right? I was going to get offered millions of dollars to do a series on Neverland or Wonderland or whatever, you know, next land was going to be. And the thing that kept coming back to me anytime I tried, because I did start another fairy tale series, and after a few weeks, I never looked at it again because I kept coming back to the idea of kids were changing. Like, I had been to over 500 schools over those 13 years. Mm. When I first started, every time I went to a school, the kids were like, they felt like champagne fizz. Like, they were curious and weird and goofy and awkward. And they'd come up to me and ask me, like, strange questions. And what's your dog name? I'm like, I don't have a dog. Like, you know what I mean? Just the usual things. And I just found them fun. And over the course, especially after COVID, I just felt the change. There was a heaviness, you know, to them. There was like this low hum of anxiety, and they always felt like a little wired, but also tired and bored. It was this strange contradiction, and I would see it in their stares, like the way they just hollowly stare at you, like when you go into a crowd. And you would see it almost in any age. And the
That's
question.
That's wild, though. You felt that.
I felt it. And I definitely had a good sample size. I didn't have polling, I didn't have expert data or, you know, any of that stuff. But the people on Earth who get to see the most kids in the most context are young adult authors, because we're on the road and we're like, you know, I'm in almost every state. I'm just seeing the consistency of that flatness.
Yeah.
And the questions are changing. So when we get to questions, normally all the hands go up and they ask, how'd you come up with this idea? How'd you become a writer? Do you ever have bad ideas? You know, how do I become a writer? Like, just like all the curious questions that kids would have. Now, even fifth, sixth grade, it'll be dead silent, and then someone will raise their hand and say, how much money do you make? Or how many TikTok followers do you have? Or if I write a sequel to your book with AI, will you sue me?
What
this
do you
is like
say?
Fifth and sixth grade. So there is an awareness of everything that's happening in the world.
Yeah.
And it's there and it's haunt and I can see, feel the cloud. And so I started to think, like, how can I take them to more, into more fairy tales? Like, to keep telling them to escape doesn't seem like the right thing to do. It's almost like I need them to understand that this world can be as wondrous as those fantasy and fairy tale worlds, you know? And
but so you kind of have to meet them where they are too, right?
This idea of transforming this world became sort of the feeling I was having. How do I make this world feel like one they want to live in?
Yeah.
You know, because I think at the base of everything, they went from curious to now I think they fear and kind of distrust the world and adults. And this feeling of, like, especially the high schoolers, they feel like they are graduating into doom, you know? They're everything about it. They're going to take on these student loans. They're not going to be able to pay back. They're not going to get a job. They don't know what to do with AI, social media, skills, like everything. They know everything. Climate, school shooting drills, everything. So they feel it. And so I thought to myself, what do I do? And that's when I started to think about neon orange. And I started to have these kind of, like, not visions necessarily, but every time I saw the color, I was like, wouldn't that be cool for a book? I didn't know what it meant, but I would see it on traffic cones and construction signs and grocery price stickers and this color. And I thought, wouldn't that be just, if you just had a book that had no title on it, no author, nothing, and it was just this neon orange brick, what would it be about? And then I realized that color was going to be for a political party, you know, and that's where the whole book started. I said, if it's a political party, who's the leader of it? I'm like, red for Republicans, blue for Democrats, and neon orange for, and then I was like, young people. And I realized where I was going. I was going to create a third party that actually was sustainable, that had the numbers to compete with red and blue, because it was all young people.
So this perfectly leads up to this one piece of the book I wanted to share for folks. So the hero of your story, if we want to call him that, is a guy named Benton Young, right? He's a teenager, pretty typical teenager, who posts this rant online, really because he's accused by a girl that he likes that he's not caring enough and isn't into enough serious stuff in the world. And he says in part this, he says, I care that a presidential election's happening with two old swamp trolls playing the greatest hits, states' rights, gay rights, gun rights, whatever rights will bribe your vote, rather than acknowledging our world is going to hell. I care that our climate is effed, the debt is effed, the system is effed, politicians are so old and corrupt they'll never fix anything because they know they're going to die before this shit storm hits them in the face like the rest of us. This is in the opening pages. You capture all of this frustration from Benton Young, who basically tells people, go out and vote for whoever you want because it doesn't matter. And they sweep him into power by saying, this is our guy.
Yeah.
And it's led by young people showing up in numbers like they never have before. And I don't want to give away too much of the book, but his win in America leads to several other teenage leaders being swept into power in other countries around the world. It is this revolution unlike anything we've ever seen, and yet not totally unbelievable.
No, I think it actually, we're starting, I finished the book in December 2024, and then within like 6 months, Nepal's government got taken by youth, Madagascar, Morocco, Kenya, you know, it's happening in South America. You're start, like, whatever I was feeling, the energy was starting. And it's funny, as you read that, I could feel my own body starting to, like, vibrate. Because when I go into high schools now on tour, I go to two or three high schools a day, talk to 200 to 300 kids at a time.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, I feel myself almost like a preacher at the pulpit being like, you have lost the most important right that is not in the Constitution, which is, yes, you have life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, great. You can have freedom of speech, but you have lost the right to be young. And they took that from you. And I had it. All the adults around you have had it. All the adults in power had it. They got to be kids. They had their own little protected bubble. Like, you do not, you know, for many reasons. And I go through all of them. And I'm basically like, this is the right you have lost, and they will not give it back to you. So what are you going to do? Like, to either get it back for yourself or your kids, or otherwise it's gone forever. So to me, the only option they have is to unite and start figuring out how to accrue political power as a cohort. So it's a pretty, like, it's an aggressive message, but I think it's a hopeful one. And that's what the book is. It's an aggressive book, but it's a hopeful book.
How is it being received? Do you go out and you talk to these kids now? Are they starting to read it? And what are they telling you?
I think what's awesome is a lot of teenagers gave up on reading.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's not because they don't want to read. It's the silence of reading creates anxiety for them. Hmm. Because they're just, to sit there with their own thoughts is very difficult. And so they ping pong between the anxiety of the silence of their own thoughts or going into their phone and immediately being in an adult space. Anytime they open their phone, they're in adult spaces. You know, TikTok and, you know, Instagram, like they're basically seeing adult posts, you know. Hmm. Half their feed is AI and porn. Like there's no escaping like the adult world, hmm. which is part of what, you know, I'm trying to help them with. And so to me, like, to get to watch them come to this book, which looks so different from any other book because it's so visual, it's multimedia, it feels like the way they process information now, it's full color. Mm. I'm able to go to them and be like, this is not a normal book. Like, this is, you know, and somebody's like, but I don't read books, they'll say. I'm like, it's not a book. It's the future. And then they'll buy it. Like, you know, because they want something to be able to, you know, get a hold of. And kids who have never read a book tear through it because it looks like their life.
Yeah.
You know, all the memes and texts and visuals and things, like, it just reminds them of their, it's not intimidating.
Yeah.
You know.
At the same time, it's about politics. Mm. I would call it a geopolitical thriller 100%. For young adults, right?
Yeah.
Someone else described it as a mix between The Hunger Games and House of Cards. Mm-hmm. Like, it's very smart.
Yeah.
You mentioned it's very aesthetically interesting, right? There's all these text messages and political ads and, like, trending reports. And you can kind of follow things happening in real time as the story unfolds. But is that, like, do kids want to read about geopolitics? Is that something you're finding?
Well, here's what's really interesting. A teacher told me, I have tried to teach the electoral map in government for many years, and the kids just glaze over. They have no interest in the electoral map because it's just so abstract to them to have to learn how the electoral system works. One of the first things you see in the book is the electoral map, but now Benton's kind of write-in campaign for president has started, like, accelerating, and he's actually winning states.
Yeah.
So you have the states divided by Republicans and Democrats, but now you have all these neon states on the electoral map that are owned by the Revolting Youth. Now it's easy
Revolting
for
Revolting Youth
that,
is the name of the party,
the name of
say.
The third party.
Yes. Yeah.
Now it's easy for that teacher to teach electoral politics because he's like, you won that state. You guys won Texas. You won Nebraska or whatever the states are in the map. And so it's inserting young people into politics, which is why, I mean, we can pivot to this thing, which is that I think one of the messages of the book is that the age gate on the presidency has to go. I think, to me, the clause in the Constitution that says you have to be 35 to run for president is a huge detriment to the young population, especially now. Because the moment you take that off and you let them participate in it, in the idea of the presidency, the fantasy of the presidency, everything changes.
So in the story, so Benton is 17,
he's
right?
17.
So he can't even legally vote.
He cannot vote. He cannot obviously run for president.
And there's a complicated story I won't get into about a competition, a three-way competition in which a Supreme Court has to weigh in and basically says, we don't believe in the age minimum anymore. We're reinterpreting this because it excludes too many potential candidates.
Essentially,
right?
What they do is they need the Republican Democrat to stop stealing the election from each other.
Right.
They make him president on a very small loophole for just long enough to get them to work out the compromise. And in that little period, the other governments fall to teenagers, and now all hell breaks loose.
Right. So they have no choice but to leave him
as
president of the United States
as
a 17-year-old. But the part of the political participation you're getting to fascinates me because we have an 18-year mark for when you can cast ballots in this country. Mm. Other countries have revisited this, right? In recent years.
Yeah.
You've seen a number of countries in Europe and I think some in South America. I think Australia is considering it, lowering the voting age to 16 in a lot of these places. Is that the kind of thing you'd like to see happen here?
No.
No.
I think it's the wrong solution because to me, it's about getting to run for president. That, to me, is the more important thing than lowering the vote to 16, because lowering the age to 16, it just makes a big gap between the 16-year-old and the median age in the House is 58, and in the Senate 65. So lowering it from 18 to 16 just creates more of this kind of feeling of alienation, right? Like, I think there was a NPR poll that came out that said 70% of young Americans 18 to 29 don't feel like they have anyone in, you know, politics that represents them. And so to me, it's more about allowing young people to fantasize about that leadership. Because when you're 18, think about all the things you can do. You can take out a credit card, a mortgage. You know, you can get married. You can vote. You can fight for your country. You can die for your country. But then you can't, like, ask your country in a democracy if you can lead it, right? And so we allow, like, we're getting to the point with life expectancy where, like, 100-year-olds are going to be in the Senate and the House and potentially the presidency. And yet we can't have, you know, an 18-year-old who's allowed to vote also run, you know. It doesn't make sense. But then we rely on the 18 to 34s to, you know, energize the base and fill the rallies and volunteer and canvass and make the memes and content. Like, they're running the campaigns, you know. I think when I went to see, I was in New York the day Zoran won the Democratic primary, and to see all the teenagers in the street and the way it felt like the book. It felt like the book. It was the first time I felt like the revolting youth were real. And yet, Mamdani can't run for president for other reasons, but he also would be age-gated from the presidency, which to me is ridiculous, because the two most powerful political forces we've had in the last 10 to 15 years were Zoran Mamdani and Charlie Kirk. Both would be age-gated from the presidency. If either one was allowed to run, you would see all the young people in this country come off the sidelines.
You think more young people would vote for younger people?
Absolutely. And it's when I go into schools and talk to kids, like, we do this sort of simulation with some test questions as to what you would do if you were president. And without fail, it becomes clear who in that group would run, and then everybody supporting them. And you also see, like, who they would pick as a, it's just natural. There's always going to be, not all young people should be president. But
thank you for clarifying.
Not all. Okay. But I will say, it's funny because I've gotten the question, like, do you actually think a teenager should be president?
Yeah.
Right. But then I'm also thinking, like, I don't know if the 70 and 80 year olds are crushing it. You know what I mean? So
do the teenagers you talk to, do they believe the teenagers should be able to run for the highest office in the land?
There's always one who, yes, they do believe it should be. Not necessarily them.
That they, yeah.
But there's always one who thinks they could do it, you know? And I think the one who could do it and having that conviction then creates this energy of, well, the other people being like, well, maybe I could run for office at my school. Maybe I could run for school board. Maybe I could run for town council. So this idea of, if you just open up the presidency, I think you supercharge all the downstream races, you know, to young people. And essentially, I just want this upswell of young people. And I also think it takes an outside voice to be able to say it, who is not young. Because if it was somebody in that teenage, or, you know, 18 to 22-year-old space, no one would take them seriously.
This is such a departure from your previous books,
yes,
right?
Yes.
That's fair to say.
I will say there is a connective thread, right? Remember I said that the Grimm's stories tell you that to get a happy ending, it's whatever the kid does, not when an adult decides for them, right? And I think it's still the same message here. It's like, it's what you're going to do. Because if you let the adults decide for you, you're in Disneyland where it's, you know, it's not the right ending.
Do you feel like this is the first in another new series? Are we going to continue to follow some of these same characters?
I would love to. I mean, I would happily spend 10 years here, you know, I would, or every 4 years. Every 4 years, there'll be a new one, you know. It took a very long time because I think it's such an immersive world that I wanted, with all the visuals, there were so many artists working on it. Like, I felt like I was making a movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It did feel like an actual production that way. So I would like to do more. But I also think what's important for me is getting to go on the road and talk about it. Because I think because of the fact that kids are increasingly scared of books, part of the thing with this is not just putting it out. It's convincing people to not give up on a book and give something a chance, you know, and to get to go in there and talk to the audience, I think is super important. So that's been a mainstay of this story.
I mean, how do you make that case? This is something we talk about a lot on our team too, about literacy rates and where they are, and the abysmal numbers of adults, even in America, who are just reading for fun. People don't read for fun, for enjoyment anymore. How do you look at that? I mean, how do you bring young people back in to this world?
It's difficult. It's why I needed the book to look different, and I needed to deconstruct what a novel looked like, so that when I go in front of young people authentically, I can say, this is not like any other book you've seen. It will meet you where you are. It will, if you've never read a book before, if you know you're a big reader, you will be fine in either case. And we tested it. We gave it to so many kids before it was published. And all I would ask is what day you started and what day you finished. I don't care if you liked it. I don't want to know anything, any reactions. I just want to know if you finished. And we were just reliably getting kids to finish. And I felt like, especially the boys who don't read anymore.
Were finishing the book.
Were finishing the book.
And what were they telling you about it?
They just were like, I've never finished the book. I finished this one. And I was like, I don't need to know anymore. You know? And I think the important thing was, in the same way that School for Good and Evil found that kind of female id, this one, I think deep down, without me realizing it, every book you, only when you're done, do you realize what you were actually doing. I think I was trying to get teenage boys back. I think that's what it was. I think it was about getting teenage boys back in the world, back in books, bringing them back from the dead-eyed stare.
Why boys in particular right now? What are you seeing?
I think it's something, I think with the girls, there's a feeling that they almost can snap out of it. Like that they still have all the capabilities and emotions and emotional intelligence and are still getting the right feedback to be able to make it out of it. Maybe because I feel like the pressures on social media that have affected them have been there for longer.
Yeah.
Social media was trying to go after boys for a long time and they couldn't figure out the formula. And I think they just figured it out in the last couple of years and made them insecure about their bodies and made them insecure about their masculinity and just essentially have tormented them into being slaves to social media the way that they used to have the girls. And so it's a more, I think, intense threat, because I just feel like they've been swallowed by this plague. And that's why the dead-eyed stare kind of scares me so much, because all their sort of like, you know, that freedom of thought and will that they used to have is suddenly gone. Whereas I think girls know the threat they're under. And I sense a feeling like they will break through. Also because I wrote so many books for them. And I think a lot of them still find pleasure in reading and escape in reading. And so I keep thinking, like, why didn't I choose a girl to be the teenage president? And I think she'd be fine. I think there'd be no book. I think she'd wander into the office, have it completely organized.
She would thrive.
She would be great. She would be great. But a teenage boy is going to have to go through some things, which is what Benton does.
So I have to ask, because you mentioned early in our conversation, you had some of that pressure to follow a more traditional career path. How does your family look at all this now? Where you are now, work, your success?
You know, my dad, both my brothers work for my dad now, and he just calls me his wild card. You know, he's like, he's like, anything can happen with him, good or bad. Like everyone else's life is like a wave machine. He goes, his is like a sine curve. It's the highest of highs, lowest of lows, you know.
Does it feel that way to you?
It does. It does feel that way. You know, it feels like, you know, anything can happen. You know, he always says, he goes, I'm a betting man, but I don't bet on someone. Because
he says that with love.
Yes. He's like, anything can happen. So I always take that as a great sign, because he moved here. He barely knew English. He, you know, became an entrepreneur and figured his way out. And I think I have some of that in me, you know, this let's go for it. The fact I left fairy tales when I was going to get so much money and stability and be fairy tale guy forever to write this, I think, again, told my dad that I'm a little crazier than most.
But everything you're talking about, it feels like you've tapped into something that we cover a lot, we talk about a lot in news world and the culture world. But this is bringing it into the fantasy world. This is sort of a reimagining of what all those social ills and pressures and frustrations, what they could lead to in an extreme kind of fantasy form.
Well, that's the thing. It's a fun maximalist version of the world in order to get teenagers to read it, right? Yeah. But to me, the message, if teenagers read it, and enough of them read it, they start to think to themselves, like, there's just these rules in the way, right? It's just one line in the Constitution, right, that is preventing this from happening. So I think it starts to make you think, like, the rules of the game can be changed, right? Politicians do it all the time. So, you know, and not just in fiction. So what would it look like if we start putting pressure on some of those rules? So to me, that's what a story can do. It can take the maximalist view, but even like 1/10 of the maximalist view in the real world would totally change everything. So that's what I'm trying to encourage them to do, is to galvanize them behind their own young cohorts and to spark that 1 in 1,000, 1 in 1,000,000 who will actually go be the next Mamdani or the next, you know, there's a 14-year-old running for governor of Vermont. There's going to be these outlying kids, and the right one's going to come at the right moment. And I think they're going to have a chance.
The book is Young World. The author is Soman Chanani. Soman, thank you so much. Such a pleasure.
This is so much fun.